There is a pretty intense public policy debate brewing. Perhaps you've heard about it. A lot of people want access to a certain substance, but the laws make it difficult or impossible to get it in many places. These people say the stuff is good for them, but the U.S. government says it's dangerous. So in many places, people have set up a black market delivery system to get their hands on the goods. They favor full legalization, but some suppliers are being raided and arrested. As you probably guessed, we are talking about milk. Raw, unpasteurized milk. BPP producer Dan Pashman has been looking into this issue. He and Wynn Rosenfeld have a video report up on our website today. And Jan, I just decided to call you.
That's cool. I'm flexible. Whatever you...
Dan hey. Joins us now in the studio. Hey, Dan.
How are you?
We're doing well. So let's talk a little bit about, first of all, why do people want raw milk? I hear that and I kind of think that sounds gross. Why do people want this?
Well, the idea is, you know, we've been pasteurizing milk for many decades. And the idea of pasteurization is that you heat the milk in order to kill potentially dangerous pathogens that could be inside the milk. But proponents of raw milk, they believe that when you're doing that, when you're killing the potentially bad stuff, that you're also killing good stuff that can provide a wide range of health benefits. The main ones are, they say that it helps your immune system to be exposed to these different kinds of bacteria. They argue that people who are lactose intolerant can drink raw milk, whereas they may not be able to drink pasteurized milk. And there's a whole other list. They say it gives you better energy, better mental health, and the list goes on and on from there. But
X-ray vision, invisibility.
That's right. Yet to be proven. But
so how do you procure this stuff? I mean, well, you said in the intro, it's kind of regulated. It's hard to get your hands on.
It is. It really depends on what state you live in. The laws vary widely. There are 8 states where you can actually buy raw milk in the store. You can just go to the store and buy raw milk, although it has to be marked clearly. There are a bunch of other states where you can only buy raw milk at the farm where the cows are being milked. It can't be taken off-site and sold elsewhere. Hmm. Then there's even a couple of states like Florida where it can only be sold as pet food. But a lot of people just buy it, marked as pet food, and then they go home and drink it themselves.
Do they have to, like, go in and bark at the clerk right. Selling it to you?
Yeah, they have to. You have to prove that you have a dog.
Oh, okay.
No, you don't.
Or
but,
are a dog.
and then even in a few other states where it's technically illegal, they still don't stop people from drinking the milk raw from their own cows if they own the cows. Mm-hmm. And so some farmers have taken to selling cow shares. So you actually buy a share of a cow, so you are ostensibly an owner of the cow, and then you can go to that farm and pick up your, quote-unquote, your milk.
Wow. So, I mean, people are going to such lengths because of the benefits that you mentioned, supposedly boosting your immune system. It helps if you're lactose intolerant. Is there any science to back up those claims?
Well, there's some.
I mean, you can find science to back up anything, I suppose.
Right. I mean, there's been a few recent interesting studies done. One was done out of in Switzerland. They had a study of 15,000 European kids. And they found that kids who drank raw milk had lower incidence of asthma and allergies, which is pretty interesting. And it was especially interesting that the earlier they started drinking the raw milk, the better the benefits, the more the benefits that they saw were. Hmm. There's also a study done that was funded by the Weston A. Price Foundation, which is an activist group in favor of raw milk. But they did an independent study which suggested that people who are lactose intolerant are more likely to be able to drink raw milk. The problem with these studies is that they don't isolate raw milk as the determining factor.
Yeah, because I imagine it's a self-selecting group that's drinking this stuff. They're probably eating really healthy anyway.
Right. They also eat. There are differences in what they eat. There are differences in where they live. There are a variety of differences. So it's very difficult, scientists say, to point to raw milk as the deciding right. factor that has brought these health benefits.
Like that Swiss study, it's probably the raw milk kids were also the macrobiotic food kids and the eat your vegetables kids and the not just eating, you know, Fritos all day kids.
Right. And they were also oftentimes kids who grew up on farms. So they were exposed to bacteria by being around animals,
right.
which is another way you can build your immune system besides just drinking raw milk.
So let's talk about the other side of this. The government says this stuff is bad for us, right? Explain. What
they
are
do.
The fears?
The Food and Drug Administration actually declined to be interviewed for our story, but they have a PowerPoint presentation on their website that leaves no questions about where they stand. They call raw milk inherently dangerous.
Huh.
Why? Well, because there have been outbreaks. There have been people who've gotten sick from drinking raw milk. Things like salmonella, brucellosis, listeria, these things can be found in raw milk. And milk that hasn't been pasteurized, they say, is more likely to make you sick. And they say that it's dangerous. So they favor not allowing it at all. So it's pretty much polar opposites in terms of that. The FDA has this PowerPoint presentation. There's actually a dueling PowerPoint presentation war on the internet. The Weston A. Price Foundation, they have a rebuttal, slide-by-slide rebuttal to that PowerPoint on their website. We've got links to all this up on our web.
Slide-by-slide throwdown.
That's right.
So there are some claims that there's food poisoning that can be connected to raw milk. What do raw milk drinkers want to happen? Are they satisfied with having to go to these extremes to get the milk, or are they urging a more open marketplace for this?
Well, they it varies a bit. It should be said that very few of them favor an end to pasteurization. They just want to be able to make the choice for themselves. And now some of them feel that raw milk should just be available in the stores like it is in those 8 states. You should just be able to go and buy it. A lot of the other ones actually like the system that's the middle ground sort of approach, which is like we have here in New York State, which is that system where it can only be sold at the farm and you need a special permit. And that allows consumers to go to the farm, see where the raw milk is being made. And a lot of them argue that it comes down to the difference between big farms and small farms, and that the FDA's approach is sort of an old school big milk industry approach of, well, this needs to be regulated because we can't keep tabs on all these things. And they say, well, at a small enough farm, if you have a farmer who really takes care of his or her milk, then you can actually ensure that raw milk will be safe.
And you and Wynn visited one of these really small farms.
We did. We went up to Freedom Hill Farm in Otisville, New York. It's about 90 miles northwest of here. We spoke to Rick and Julie Vreeland, who started selling milk as a hobby and ended up getting so many demands for raw milk. Rick said that it was like they put a sign outside that said free drugs for addicts.
That's crazy.
Last summer, they started selling raw milk. They sold 13 gallons in the first month. This past month, they sold more than 1,000. Gallons.
Wow.
And Rick is perfectly qualified to talk about big farm versus small farm because he used to run a farm with 2,000 cows. And he flat out said he didn't drink the milk raw from that old farm because he wasn't the one milking the cows. The cows are getting milked at 2 in the morning while he's sleeping. So an honest mistake could be made and something could get into the milk and it could be a very dangerous, honest mistake.
So there's a lot of trust that's involved in this process, too. The people who are taking this unpasteurized milk from these farmers, I mean, they're just trusting them that they're handling it well.
They are, but they're also taking a lot of initiative on their own to go to the farm. And that's one of the things that the consumers at this farm in New York State that we talked to said, we like that we can come here. We know Rick and Julie. We know the people. We can look at the cows. We can watch them milk the cows. And so we can see for ourselves that the milk is being handled properly.
Is it your impression that even the most radical pro raw milk people don't say, oh, there's nothing to worry about, just put it on the shelves next to the regular milk? Or even the people who are the biggest pro raw milk people, do they say things like, you still have to be careful, you still have to know where it's coming from, let's be cautious about this?
I'm sure you could find a couple of people on the far end. But in general, they do favor standards specifically for raw milk because one of the arguments that they make is that they believe that at bigger factory farms, basically the farmers take pasteurization for granted and just assume they can let whatever they want get into the milk and they can have low standards because pasteurization will take care of it after the fact.
Two more questions. First, did you ever taste this stuff?
I did, and I must say it was delicious.
Seriously?
It was. It was creamier than any other milk, creamier and richer than any other milk. And it backs up the idea that, I mean, pasteurization has been fine-tuned. The process has been to find a balance between safety and flavor. You don't want to sterilize the milk because then it loses flavor. And there was a whole lot of flavor in the raw milk.
But I can't – milk flavor. I don't know if I want more milkiness in my – anyway, the last question.
Yeah. There
was
You're
so
just afraid of the milkiness. You don't know what milkiness can mean to
you.
I
guess not. There was so much science, really interesting stuff that you learned out of this. Tell us about some of the things that surprised you.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that didn't fit into the video but I found super interesting. One is that we're learning more and more that bacteria plays a more integral role in human life and the human immune system than we previously knew.
Because we think bacteria, we think bad.
Right. You see those commercials for antibacterial soaps, and you see these cartoons
like
of big evil
monsters.
Yeah. Right.
They look like the cavity creeps from Crest commercials.
Right.
A little bit.
And the truth is that a lot of while probably more bacteria are bad than good, there are a lot of good bacteria out there. And one of the most interesting things I learned is about this stuff called oligosaccharides. It's a sugar that is in human breast milk. And it goes, the baby gets it from the mother, but the baby cannot digest oligosaccharides. So you would say, why after millions of years of evolution is the mother still producing them?
Yeah.
Well, that's because oligosaccharides are essentially bacteria food for good bacteria. They are a food that goes into the baby and creates a breeding ground for good bacteria to help the baby ward off bad bacteria.
I never knew that.
And one of the scientists I spoke to, Bruce German, he said that down the road we're going to industrialize good bacteria, and that instead of having antibacterial sprays for your countertops, you're going to have sprays with good bacteria, and you're going to spread good bacteria on your countertops to get rid of the bad bacteria.
Totally fascinating. It's a great video report. Go check it out online at npr.org/Brian Park. Thank you, Dan Pashman.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Fascinating stuff. Right. Participate in the online discussion as well.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The most common explanation for Alzheimer's disease is that it's caused by sticky clumps of something called amyloid. It gradually builds up in the brain and kills off brain cells. But two new studies suggest that a very different and far more familiar substance may be just as important, calcium. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
While most researchers have concentrated on the role of amyloid plaques in Alzheimer's, a few have long suspected that the real culprit might be calcium. Kevin Foskett of the University of Pennsylvania is one of those researchers. He says there wasn't that much evidence the calcium hypothesis was right until today's publication of the two new studies.
Taking these two papers together will force everyone in the Alzheimer's field to put the calcium hypothesis much more on the map than it has been.
Foskett, who is an author of both papers, says the hypothesis goes like this. Calcium molecules pass in and out of individual brain cells.
Cells can let calcium come in from the outside, or they also have stores of calcium that they keep inside them, and they can release that calcium from the inside of the cell into the cytoplasm.
In order to stay healthy, brain cells need to maintain just the right amount of calcium at any given moment. That depends on cells responding to signals from elsewhere in the brain. Foskett and others think an abnormal response to these signals leads to abnormal calcium levels in brain cells, which ultimately leads to Alzheimer's. One of the new studies appears to confirm the link between calcium and Alzheimer's. Philippe Marambeau of Albert Einstein Medical College says the study identifies a gene linked to both Alzheimer's and the calcium balance in brain cells. He says people who carry one copy of the gene are at least 44% more likely to develop the disease.
So it's extremely significant, and it could potentially affect a lot of individuals.
This is only the second gene that's been linked to the most common form of Alzheimer's. And Marambeau says scientists know a lot about the chemicals it produces in the brain.
So we have potentially not only identified a new risk factor, but also a gene product that could be targeted for drug discovery and therapy.
Future drugs might be designed to correct abnormal calcium levels in brain cells. So far, efforts to treat Alzheimer's have focused on preventing or eliminating the buildup of amyloid. The second new study suggests how an imbalance in calcium might actually cause Alzheimer's. Researchers looked at brain cells from people who have a rare inherited form of the disease that can strike a person before they reach 40. They found that these people carry genes that not only cause amyloid buildup, but also problems with calcium regulation. And the study found that when calcium regulation went awry, brain cells produced more amyloid. Sam Gandy with the Alzheimer's Association says that suggests a brand new way of looking at an old disease.
It seems that calcium and amyloid have a sort of hand-in-glove or even vicious cycle sort of relationship. So one can cause the other, and they can begin a vicious cycle that we think can lead to the disease.
All the scientists warned against trying to prevent Alzheimer's by changing the amount of calcium in your diet or by taking drugs that affect the way cells use calcium. The new studies appear in the journals Cell and Neuron. John Hamilton, NPR News.
In a bearish economy, we're in the midst of a very bullish art market. The record for a Claude Monet painting was shattered at Christie's in London yesterday when one of his water lilies paintings sold for more than $80 million. Last month, a work by Lucien Freud fetched more than $33 million, the most ever paid for a work by a living artist. And a Francis Bacon triptych went for more than $86 million. NPR's Elizabeth Blair paid a visit to a collector.
When you step off the elevator to Aaron Levine's law office, the first thing you see is art. 10 large prints bursting with color, pastel and fluorescent pinks and yellows. On closer inspection, you see that at the center of each print is an electric chair.
People don't know that they're Andy Warhols, and when they ask, I tell them that these are clients whose cases I lost.
His wry sense of humor aside, Aaron Levine is a trial lawyer who has successfully sued pharmaceutical companies for the past 4 decades. In his spare time, he and his wife are serious collectors. Works by Warhol, Jasper Johns, Roy Lichtenstein, and dozens of other established artists grace the walls. And that's just his office. Aaron Levine says the economic downturn has not affected his collecting, and he doesn't think he's alone. He went to Art Basel, the big art fair in Switzerland, earlier this month.
I don't see, from my recent trip, any lessening in the ferociousness of the contemporary art collector, nor their pocketbook.
But he did notice one difference.
In Basel, it used to be one-third Americans, and now it's about 10% Americans.
One reason could be the weak dollar. The other, new wealth overseas. It seems that a very small group of ultra-rich buyers is keeping the high-end art market alive, says Josh Baer, a private dealer who writes the arts industry blog The Baer Facts. He says the new collectors are from Russia, Asia, India, and other places.
5 or 10 years ago, they had nothing on their walls. The American collectors, the major ones, have been collecting for 20, 30, 40 years. So they already have a number of masterworks themselves. So they're in less of a hurry to need to buy one more.
Take the Russian billionaire art lover Roman Abramovich. He bought both the Lucian Freud and the Francis Bacon at auction last month for about $120 million. In other words, even though fewer people are bidding, those who are have enough money to drive prices way up. And while that's gotten a lot of attention, it is not the whole story. The art market is going in two directions. Ian Peck, president of the Art Capital Group, says the auction houses hold separate sales based on price.
The Part 1 sales are $1 million plus works, and the Part 2 sales are anywhere from a few thousand up to $1 million, let's say. And if you compare the two, there's much, much greater weakness in the Part 2.
So the high end is through the roof, and the market for everything else is softening. The economy is also affecting how purchases are made. Peck's company, the Art Capital Group, lends money to people who want to buy art. They use the artwork itself as collateral for the loan. Peck says he's seen a 30% increase in the number of loan applications from this time last year.
One of the reasons we attribute is the economy, and that some people need liquidity to cover other investments that they have that may not be doing so well.
Of course, these are people who aren't really hurting financially. So what does this all mean for average art lovers who get their art fix from museums? Jonathan Feinberg is an art history professor at the University of Illinois.
Museums can no longer afford to buy the great works of art that should be available to the public because they've been consistently outbid by private individuals who are making huge amounts of money in the corporate world.
But Feinberg says you can't paint this with one stroke. There are many excellent private collectors who routinely lend to public museums. The public good, though, is hardly on the minds of folks at Sotheby's and Christie's. Both are holding auctions in Paris and London this week, and there's no sign that the art market bubble is ready to burst. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. It's June, the midpoint for the year 2008. The year is half over. And to mark the occasion, All Songs Considered, NPR's online music show, is asking listeners to vote on their favorite records for the first half of the year. All Songs Considered host Bob Boylan joins me on All Things Considered now with some of the early results from the poll. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Michelle.
It's interesting to talk about this kind of polling in this election year.
And this poll is full of surprises, like a lot of polls. And one of the surprises that I find is some of the records that are doing best are actually the records that take a lot of listening to get through. And those are not usually the ones that make it to the top of best of lists. They're usually the ones that, people will cite as things that they loved over time, but not floating to the top. And one of them is a record by a fellow who goes by the name of Bon Iver. B-O-N, next word, I-V-E-R. It's a wrong spelling of a French word. that means good winter. Mm-hmm. And Justin Vernon, the fellow who did all of this music, calls his record Bon Iver because he spent 3 months running away from whatever people run away from, bad relationships and all that other stuff, and went to his father's cabin up in northern Wisconsin, alone with some recording equipment, and just made this absolutely stunning, out-of-the-blue record. I am my mother on the wall with a song.
Music's beautiful, but boy, he whatever happened left quite a mark on him. He's talking about love leaving rope burns.
It is absolutely one of my favorite records, and not unlike another record that is slowly gaining to be a favorite of mine and making it surprisingly onto the charts. It's one by a group called Fleet Foxes, who I've only heard of this year. They're a pretty young band from Seattle.
I was following the eye, 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 was following the eye.
The heart and soul of this band are the voices, so it's not the guitar and the drums that are carrying it. It's not one singer. They're all singers. You know, the first thing I thought about, and you hate saying this because you don't want to pigeonhole them, but the first thing I thought about in my reference points is Crosby, Stills, and Nash or something like that. But there's lots more than that to this band.
Bob, it almost has a 1960s Up With People feeling.
Oh, you know, if they were in the room here, they would scowl.
So there are bands that are, at least at this point in time, a little bit more obscure, but there are some more familiar bands, I understand, that actually made it to the top of the rankings.
You know, and Death Cab for Cutie. A storm. Morning Jacket are two bands that have been around for a long time now. They've steadily built up a following, being young, independent. When we say independent, we mean on small labels, who are now not on small labels. And what's hopeful is you get these bands that you may fall in love with when they're young and they're just beginning, and that's what you like about them. But they have managed to mature, and we should play maybe something from the My Morning Jacket record. This record's full of many different styles. You can listen to one and you might feel like you're listening to Charlie Pride, and the next minute you feel like you're listening to Led Zeppelin. So this record's all over the map. It's one of the reasons I love this band so much. One of the things that I see in Death Cab for Cutie and My Morning Jacket, bands that have now been around for a while, is that you see them actually selling an awful lot of records, and you'll see them on the in the tops of Billboard charts. These are bands that, you know, given the kind of music they made 6 and 8 years ago, you never, ever would have imagined them selling a lot of records and selling out big halls and so forth. And so when you think of someone like Bon Iver or you think of someone like Fleet Foxes, it's curious to think about 5 and 6 and 8 years from now if they will be ones who forge a new sound, a different sound, a sound that in some ways expands the attention span. So maybe there's some hope, because I like that in music when it takes a while to kind of fall for it. And maybe that's something that we can look forward to for pop music, because heaven knows I listen to too much pop music that in the first 10 or 15 seconds, you know the whole song.
Yeah, you hear the hook and you know you're going to hear it six times before the song's
over. Right, and I'm tired of that.
Bob, what's at the top of the poll right now?
Well, Bon Iver and Vampire Weekend were running neck and neck for a while, and now Vampire Weekend is taking a big lead. And if you haven't heard the Vampire Weekend, you should, because it's such a fun, upbeat record. You've got to find room and heart for a record that's this much fun.
Bob Boylan is the host of All Songs Considered. Thanks for stopping by, Bob.
Pleasure.
And you can hear some of our listeners' picks and vote for your own favorites if you go to the music section of our website. That's npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Back when Americans were listening to Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles, China's airwaves were full of songs with lyrics from Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. Things have loosened up a bit since then, but China's government still bans music that mentions sex, violence, or has low-class humor. That rules out a good chunk of the Ryan Seacrest Top 40. Turn on the radio in China today, and you're most likely to hear something like this. Yeah. Well, now the internet has given Chinese music fans free access to pretty much everything. As part of our series on the effect of the internet on Chinese arts and culture, NPR's Laura Seidel has this profile of an independent musician using the internet to make a name for himself.
B6 is eating a slice of pizza when he opens the door of his apartment.
Hi, I'm Laura. Nice to meet you.
The 27-year-old electronic musician lives and works in a high-rise on the outskirts of the city. We sit down in his studio, and he explains it was the internet that really allowed him to explore his passion for electronic music.
While I was in high school, I used to listen to rock and roll music. It was very hard to get foreign or Western music. You had to go to the black market to get CDs.
But when B6 got access to the internet in 1999, it opened up a whole new world.
We used those peer-to-peer websites like Napster to download music.
B6 fell in love with electronic music such as techno and intelligent dance music out of Detroit, Michigan. Now his own compositions range from dance music to the contemplative. This is a piece he calls My Post-Rock Yard. It's about the small and somewhat disheveled garden outside the window of his studio.
People misunderstand electronic music. Electronic music does not necessarily have to be cold. It can be very human, and even warmer than acoustic music.
Not only is the internet helping B6 find new music, it's helping him make a living from his work. Until recently, musicians who weren't officially sanctioned by the government couldn't sell CDs or get airplay. But now the market has opened up.
Sometimes I sell some of my own CDs, and sometimes I help do soundtracks for commercials and movies, and sometimes I do soundtracks for installation art at galleries.
B6 knows it's rare to be able to make a living from your music in China, and he wants to help other independent musicians support themselves. So a couple of years ago, he became one of the founders of a website called Neocha. He and co-founder Sean Liao wanted to figure out a way for independent musicians to make money. But Liao says they didn't know what it was.
Necessity is the mother of invention, in that Chinese musicians and Chinese labels and everybody that's in this industry is getting pushed so hard and trying to figure this model out that maybe they'll come on a solution before someone in the U.S. does.
Neocha sells advertising and they split the revenue with the artists. They don't even bother trying to sell the music because there's so much piracy in China, there is no point. One way Neocha promotes the music is with an online music player called Next. Turn it on and you can listen to a random sampling of songs by Neocha musicians. Don't like that? Click the button that says Next and you get something else. Sean Liao says that what independent musicians in China need is a way to make a living with their music.
It's kind of a cyclical thing that we need to help them just get to a level where they can start making some money so that they can live out and achieve their creative potential.
The internet isn't just a way to help musicians make money, it's also a way for them to connect with each other. It's a Thursday night, and B6 is hopping on a packed train with three musicians from Japan. They're all heading to play a club in Nanjing, a gig they planned together online.
We have like the internet, like MSN live message, so we can, you know, get connected with all the musicians from all over the world.
2.5 hours later, they arrive in Nanjing and head to a smoky basement club called Castle Bar. It's packed with trendy-looking young Chinese and Westerners. It's a pastiche of brightly colored hair, cargo pants, blue jeans, and short skirts. B6 stands behind a glass window in the DJ booth. His MacBook is hooked into the sound system. The crowd looks on and then starts to move out to the dance floor. The club doesn't empty out until after 3 a.m. A couple of fans stop to talk with me, Johnny Ju and Yao Lian. They give the same answer when I ask them how they first heard electronic music.
On website.
Internet.
B6 has his criticisms of the way the Communist Party still manages the media in his country, but he feels optimistic about the future. He says the government is trying to encourage creativity.
I know that in the minds of many foreigners, China is the world's factory. That is not the image the Chinese government would like to project to the world.
B6 says the government wants the Chinese people to be more creative, so he believes there will be more openings for independent artists like himself, especially as more young people explore what's on the internet. Here's a song by B6 about what he thinks the world will be like in 50 years. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Coming up tomorrow, Chinese novelists putting their writing online. They're applying new technology to an old Chinese tradition of underground writing. Back in the time of Mao, writers had to pass around notebooks with their handwritten novels.
It was very dangerous to copy them and to pass them around. You could get in trouble if you got caught with them.
Now, internet novelists get their readers to pay by the chapter, and some of them are breaking into traditional publishing.
traveling around with all the comforts of home. Commentator Frank DeFord remembers a different kind of summer experience.
I was very lucky as a kid because I got to go away to camp 2 summers. We did all kind of stuff at camp. We played baseball and basketball and tennis and shot rifles and arrows and swam and rode horses. We did handicrafts, too. That's never been my best territory, though. I confined myself to making potholders, of which my mother accumulated legion during my fertile handicraft years. We lived in cabins and used outhouses, and of course, this being camp, we camped out some in pup tents. When the girls' camp from nearby came over for a dance, we put on a water ballet exhibition, holding candles in the stream, treading water to The Tales of the Vienna Woods. Back home, summers we improvised at games. People who are either depression babies or war babies always boast about how summers they just went out and played stuff without any supervision. It was the boomers who started getting all kinds of organized sports in the summer, little league and what have you. The boomers needed parents to drive them places and coaches to coach them. Then by the time we got to Gen X, summer play wasn't just organized. It had a specific purpose, resume-wise. You went to a baseball camp or a cheerleader camp or a bodybuilding camp. For the current generation of 21st century kids, whatever they're called, the camps have become downright vocational. A boy who has parents who think he can win an athletic scholarship as a quarterback gets sent to quarterback camp or pitching camp or goalie camp. They probably have offensive left tackle camps now because offensive left tackles make a bundle in the NFL. Summer for children now is a time of apprenticing. Nobody anymore is treading water with a candle to a Strauss waltz. No future in that. After 2 summers at camp, I could have gone back to camp the next summer and been a junior counselor. I wouldn't have had to make any more potholders, but there was still that outhouse situation to consider. Besides, I wanted to make some money caddying. Caddies have all but gone now, of course, which is too bad. Monday was caddies' day at most courses, so a lot of poor boys could learn the game that way. A lot of good golfers started out as caddies. But now, if a kid wants to learn golf, he has to go to golf camp. In fact, I suppose by now there are also putting camps and sandwich camps.
Commentator Frank DeFord pitches his tent here every Wednesday, joining us from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.